Her beauty, as we are told, was in itself not altogether incomparable, nor such as to strike those who saw her. But converse with her had an irresistible charm, and her presence, combined with the persuasiveness of her discourse and the character which was somehow diffused about her behaviour towards others, had something stimulating about it. There was sweetness also in the tones of her voice, and her tongue, like an instrument of many strings, she could readily turn to whatever language she pleased. So that is the historian Plutarch talking about Cleopatra the Seventh, the subject of this mini-series. And Tom, that's one of the only real descriptions that we have of Cleopatra's appearance and personality. That's not just sort of propagandistic invective. And we have a question from Dr. Dan, the bandage man, one of our listeners, asking about Cleopatra's beauty. Because, of course, she's probably the best-known character in history for her looks.
Yeah.
But what's the truth there? Do you think she... I mean, Plutarch says she wasn't particularly beautiful. So what's the story?
Yeah, I mean, the image of her, certainly in the 19th century, she becomes the toast of kind of symbolists and decadents. And she's cast as this kind of exquisitely beautiful predatory vampiress. Who kills courtiers? She sleeps with a man every night and then kills him in the morning. All this kind of stuff. And the assumption is that she's very, very sexual and she's very, very beautiful. And actually, I think neither of those things are true. Yeah. She seems to have been, I mean, not particularly stunningly beautiful. If you look at the coins, she has quite a kind of hawk nose, and she doesn't look absolutely stunning. And as Plutarch describes her, her fascination seems to lie not in her looks so much as in her character. And I think that it's the age cannot wither her nor custom stale her infinite variety that you get in Shakespeare's portrayal of her. And there's this wonderful description that Ena Barbus, who is Antony's sidekick, Henobarbus, Domitius Henobarbus, the original. And he's trying to explain to someone what it is about Cleopatra that makes her so compelling. And he says, "I saw her once hop 40 paces through the public street, and having lost her breath, she spoke and panted that she did make defect perfection." And I think that brilliantly gets something that's there in Plutarch. This sense that there is a kind of fascination that's not dependent on, you know, conventional beauty. It's just that she is a very, very compelling person. And I think that as we'll explore on the question of, is she a massively sexual person? As far as we know, she only ever slept with two men.
Yeah.
And both those men happen to be the most powerful men in the world.
Well, they're both much older men and much more powerful men. They're both Romans.
And she knows how to, she tailors her self-presentation.
Yes.
To suit what she knows about their respective characters.
But do you think, even though, I mean, as we said in our first episode, everything we know about, well, almost everything that's written down in narrative form about Cleopatra comes from the Romans and comes from her enemies. Despite that, don't you agree that you can sort of, bleeding out between the gaps, you get a sense of the charisma?
Absolutely. So Plutarch, he talks about his grandfather knew someone who worked at the court of Cleopatra.
That's right, Philotas, I think his name was, a medical student.
Yes, and he talks about how they have banquets all the time. They're constantly cooking in the kitchens, and this is simply so that Cleopatra and Antony can have a banquet whenever they want.
Yeah,
but you do get the sense there of a living tradition. The romance and the power and the charisma of Cleopatra has kind of survived to be something to be repeated down the generations and to be reported by Plutarch 150 years after.
I'm so glad you mentioned that, because I think that's such a lovely story, because so many of the Roman histories, there's a sense of them adhering to formulae and propagandistic formulae. And that bit when Plutarch says, "My grandfather knew somebody called Philotas who was then a medical student and went to the kitchens and all that." I mean, it's so contemporary, actually.
Yeah.
Isn't it? It's such a lovely detail. And it's all about the luxury of Cleopatra's court.
And I think it means that when Plutarch says that she had this charisma and this power, you feel that is, you know, that those are authentic reports that have been handed down. And she must have had that power.
Yeah.
Simply because of what she does, you know, the extraordinary scale of her career. And she's very, very clever as well. So Plutarch says that she spoke, is it 9 languages?
Something like that, yeah.
The language which I think of Latin, interestingly, is not one.
The Ethiopians, the Troglodytes, the Hebrews, Arabians, Syrians, Medes, and Parthians. And she then said, and Plutarch then says, it is said that she knew the speech of many other peoples also, although the kings of Egypt before her had not even made an effort to learn the native language.
Yeah, so she's the first to speak.
Speak Egyptian. The only explanation for that, presumably, is that she's clever. I mean, she's living in, surrounded by the library and the museum
clever,
these scholars. And
but I think she also, we're talking about this at the end of the previous episode. She is a young woman in a man's world. And she is recognizing that if she can cast herself as the image of the goddess Isis, the goddess who presides over the Nile, who presides over the rhythms of life in this ancient country, then she will be able to draw on wellsprings of loyalty that her forebears camped out in Alexandria, this alien Greek city kind of attached to Egypt, had never been able to do. And that is exactly what happens. And she makes incredible play with it.
We ended the last episode really with her succession. She becomes pharaoh or joint pharaoh with her brother Ptolemy XIII in 51 BC. And you promised us lots of geopolitical context because we're getting into toward the Roman Civil War, the civil war between Caesar and Pompey. She has all kinds of problems, you know, in her kind of intray. So the level of the Nile is a big issue, whether there's going to be enough rain, famine. The level of taxation. Her father has devalued the drachma as part of his way of kind of trying to pay off all these debts and stuff. So she's also got the issue, which you alluded to before, of her brother and her brother's ministers conspiring against her and trying to sort of force her out. So sort of how does she deal with all this? I mean, it's a mess, isn't it?
Her father's courtiers clearly think that both of them should be puppets. It's evident that Cleopatra is not going to play this part. And so there are two in particular. There's a guy called Achilles, who is a military man.
Yeah.
And there's a guy called Pothinus, who regular listeners to the show will be pleased to know is a eunuch.
Well, he's the man who you see, if ever you watch a program about Cleopatra, you know, he's always the man. We don't know what he looked like. We don't know anything like that. But casting directors, without fail, say, get the fattest man in the agency.
Shave his head.
Yes. And make him really sinister and simpering and effeminate. And he, Pothinus, is always played that way, isn't he?
Yes, absolutely. So Cleopatra basically gets forced out of Alexandria and she goes off with her younger sister, Arsinoe, to try and raise troops in Syria. And she comes down to Sinai and she kind of raises tribes there. And there's a town called Pelusium, which is basically guards. It's the gateway to Egypt. And Cleopatra is lurking beyond Pelusium with her forces. And her brother Ptolemy XIII is under the thumb of all these various sinister ministers in Alexandria. And so it looks as though Egypt is going to erupt into civil war.
But she's blocked there, Tom, by the way.
She's
blocked by the army because in the previous episode, we talked about that guy, Aulus Gabinius, who had recaptured. And his men are still there, aren't they? The Gabinians, they're mercenaries and sort of, they're supposedly, some of them are Germans and some of them are Norsemen. And they've just been sort of hanging around in Egypt, sort of wenching, falling out of taverns, attacking people in the street, just making a nuisance of themselves. They're like the sort of 1970s football hooligans on tour.
Yes.
And the Egyptians can't get rid of them. And they are serving in Ptolemy's army. And they're basically blocking the way at Pelusium. Yep. So she can't get past into Egypt.
So that's the situation in Egypt. It's kind of incipient civil war. But that is very much a sideshow for what meanwhile is going on in the broader Mediterranean, which is that Julius Caesar has crossed the Rubicon. And if you want the background to that, we've done 2 episodes on the build-up to Caesar crossing the Rubicon. Pompey has taken command of what he sees as the kind of the constitutional legitimate role. He stands at the head of the vast majority of the Senate. They have fled Rome. They've crossed the Adriatic. They've gone to Greece. Caesar has made sure of Spain. He's made sure of Italy. He then crosses with his fleet to Greece. He's vastly outnumbered. He ends up meeting with Pompey's armies at a place called Pharsalus. And against the odds, he beats Pompey.
Why does he beat Pompey, Tom, just very quickly?
He's a better general. He's a cleverer, subtler general. Pompey is overconfident.
Yeah.
And Caesar is at the head of men who have been following him for years and years, who have absolute confidence in him, whose morale is sky high, who believe that they can do anything. Pompey is very much kind of resting on his laurels. He's drawing on a reputation that by this point is a decade and more old, and he doesn't have the legions to hand. So he had, you know, this had been pointed out to him in the build-up to the Rubicon, and Pompey had said, well, I just have to stamp my foot and legions will emerge from out of the soil of Italy. But it didn't work like that. You know, Caesar's legions are just too proficient. Caesar is too, you know, they're too battle-honed. And so Pompey loses. He flees the battlefield, and he then has to decide, well, what am I going to do? And because he is the great conqueror of the East, he is the man who had brought much of the Near East under Roman power, who has kings across the Near East as his clients, he assumes that he can draw on them. And so he thinks, well, who is the richest, who is the most useful of these royal clients? It's the king of Egypt.
Yeah.
And so he decides he will go to Egypt, he will go to Alexandria, he will throw his weight around, he will pull rank, and he will get enough money to raise money, to raise troops, to go and have another crack at Caesar. So
that's
his plan.
That's not a bad stratagem when you think about it, is it? He's lost Pharsalus, but he knows that the Egyptians owe him, because he'd always been very close to Auletes, Cleopatra's father. He knows that Egypt is torn apart by this incipient civil war. So he can kind of go in as the strong man, and basically he knows there's a boy king.
Yeah.
So Pompey just kind of thinks, well, this is great. But unfortunately, he
is the strong man. He sees himself as a strong man. It never crosses his mind that the fact that he's lost means that suddenly his image is no longer that of a strong man, but of an absolute loser.
So there's this famous scene, isn't there, where so Ptolemy the 13th, the boy king, Cleopatra's still out there in the sort of the edge of the
Beyond
Delta.
Pelusium, yeah.
The boy king's ministers, they have this meeting and they say, what are we going to do? Pompey's coming. And supposedly there's a guy who's his tutor, Theodotus of Chios, I think it is, Tom, who I describe in my book as an oily man.
Not dealing in stereotypes.
No, but, well, he behaves in a very, I don't know anything about Chios. I mean, they may be very unoily for all I know, but he behaves in a very oily way because he basically says, well, you know, if we accept Pompey, we make ourselves Julius Caesar's enemies and Pompey will just boss us around and be a pain. If we turn him away, he will be our enemy. And if he then wins, we're in a mess. And he says, and the quote is, there's only one way to please Caesar and have nothing to fear from Pompey. And he says, and that is, welcome Pompey and kill him. For as we all know, dead men don't bite, which is such a fantastic line. And then there's this incredible scene, isn't there, where Pompey, who is, as you say, this ancient war hero, he pitches up on his boat. They send a little fishing boat to greet him. The fishing boat has Achillas on, who is Ptolemy's commander, and an old associate of Pompey's called Lucius Septimius, who sort of says, well, he doesn't say anything at first, and Pompey says to him, don't I recognize you? Didn't you used to be an old comrade of mine? Septimius says, yes, and they sail back towards the coast. And Pompey's got his speech with him that he's going to read to Ptolemy the 13th, this sort of speech of welcome. And it's while he's reading it, I think, that they begin to pull their knives out of the scabbards. And then just as they're approaching the shore, as he can see the boy king on the beach, surrounded by the oily tutor, and the fleshy eunuch, and all these other characters, they cut Pompey's head off. What a twist. Do you think do you think Pompey was hard done by there, Tom?
I think he had it coming.
You think he had it coming? Well, I know
I'll tell you who else thought he had it coming.
Go on.
Were the Jews. Because Pompey had captured Jerusalem and the temple. And of course, no non-Jew was allowed to go into the temple. But Pompey went in and he went right into the Holy of Holies. And the Jews said that from that point on, everything started going wrong for him.
Yeah.
And when the news came out that he'd been beheaded, Jewish poets hailed this as the victory of God over the pride of the dragon, and said of Pompey that he had failed to recognize that God alone is great.
Well,
so you can see how this stuff reverberates, you know, and is interpreted in all kinds of different ways by different peoples You know, this is huge, huge stuff. And of course, the people with whom it reverberates most of all are the Romans, and specifically Julius Caesar, who's come with a very, very light force, so not a large number of men at all, in pursuit. And he turns up in Alexandria, and he is presented with Pompey's head on a kind of silver salver. And Caesar affects to weep. I mean, maybe he did. We don't know.
So here's the fascinating thing. So Caesar has come in pursuit of Pompey. He gets to Alexandria, this sort of strange semi-colony, I guess, or semi-detached colony, or whatever you want to call it, on the fringe of the Roman Imperium.
But, the greater city in the world. I mean, it's larger at this point than Rome.
The richest city, exactly, the richest city in the world. So Caesar arrives. It's the first time he's been to Alexandria, this Greek city. He gets off his boat. All these people are there. They say, here's the head of your enemy. We've cut it off for you. And famously, Tom, he starts crying and says, oh, what a terrible shame Pompey was a Roman.
But he's obviously secretly incredibly relieved.
Do you think, so how seriously does Caesar take this business, this ideological business of he's a Roman, how dare you cut his head off?
I think that he feels genuine grief because the men had been close. I think that as a Roman, he thinks it's outrageous that as great a figure as Pompey has been dispatched by people you may well describe as fleshy and oily. I mean, because those are absolutely the terms in which Romans regard sinister kind of Hellenistic Greeks.
Tom, I think beheading people on boats is poor form. I'm not going to apologize for dissing Theodotus.
You know, the shrewdest political player, one of the shrewdest who's ever lived, of course he understands that this is a godsend because Pompey has been removed, cleared from the chessboard, and he's not responsible.
Well, Tom, here's the thing. You talk about Caesar's shrewdness. So Julius Caesar, we talked about him in the Rubicon podcasts. He's this incredibly experienced, shrewd, cunning, ruthless commander. And now he does something quite odd. So he takes his small force, as you said, and he basically says, let's go to the palace quarter. Let's occupy the palace quarter and establish ourselves there. Even though the Alexandrian crowd are absolutely furious to see him, and clearly the mood of the city is very much against him. And he sort of barricades himself into this sort of compound. Why?
Well, not only that, but he behaves absolutely as a kind of plenipotentiary. He summons both Ptolemy the 13th and Cleopatra into his presence. And he is going to decide which of them should rule and what the ordering of Egypt should be. And I think the reason that he does this, well, he needs the money. He also has a civil war. He has a civil war to continue fighting. He's defeated Pompey, but there are plenty of people out there who want to continue the fight against him. So Egypt is very rich, and he wants to do what Romans have always done, which is to screw money out of, their hapless underlings. And Caesar claims to be owed money back from, the days when Ptolemy Auletes, Cleopatra's father, had been handing out bribes in Rome. Caesar had scooped up a lot, and he claimed to be owed even more. So I think that's the reason. The question is, why does he do this when he has so few people and at his back? And I think it's just that he's overconfident. And right. I think that the corollary of that, I think that he takes the kind of the Roman stereotyping of Egyptians literally. He thinks these are effeminate, sinister, decadent, inbred, corrupt people who are simply not worthy of, I don't even need to show them the respect of worrying about what they might do. So these are not Gauls.
He's Vladimir Putin on the night of the 25th of February.
Yes. And the truth is that, Caesar fights an enormous number of campaigns over the course of his career. What happens in Alexandria, he comes closest to being defeated and destroyed, closer than at any point in his career.
That's a brilliant story in itself, and we'll get to it in a second. But Cleopatra, we left her. She's got her little army. They're out sort of by the delta, desperate to get past Pelusium, this fortress, and this army to Alexandria. And she can't get there. He's summoned her, but she can't get there. Now, Tom, let's take a break and find out what she does and whether or not it involves a carpet.
Yes, let's do that. Okay.
It was night in Alexandria. Darkness had fallen over the greatest city on earth, a black veil of baleful silence. Soldiers patrolled the walls of the palace, spears in hand. It was the late summer of 48 BC, and Alexandria was a city on edge, a powder keg waiting for a spark. in the inky waters of the harbour, a battered little fishing boat rounded the corner and eased towards the shore. Keeping clear of the beam from the great lighthouse, the oarsman pulled into the quayside. Working swiftly, he made fast to the jetty before clambering up the ladder, a bulky bundle on his back. A carpet? A sack? In the darkness, it was impossible to be sure. So Tom Holland, that was a reading from a fantastic new children's history of Cleopatra, which the listeners will not need me to recommend because they've already bought it, Adventures in Time, Cleopatra, Queen of the Nile, by myself. But Tom, is Cleopatra in that bag?
Well, so we left her, didn't we, at the head of her rag bag of Syrian mercenaries and tribesmen from the Sinai Desert at Pelusium, and Caesar has summoned her, and Cleopatra knows that she has to get to Caesar somehow. And so we have this story that's told in Plutarch, although not, interestingly, in Cassius Dio, who's a later historian of this period, actually a historian of the whole of Rome, but he writes about this period, and he does not include this story, so that might raise eyebrows, but I think it's true.
Yeah. You do.
Plutarch is nearer in time. And the reason I think it's true is that it's true to Cleopatra's character and it's true to Caesar's character.
It's the theatricality of it that is the key, isn't it?
So the tradition is that presumably Cleopatra kind of goes down, she sneaks past, she goes down the Nile, she brought up the Nile to Alexandria and then smuggled in what is traditionally described as a carpet. But that's a 19th century translation of Plutarch. It wasn't a carpet.
It's probably a linen bag or something, laundry bag.
It was
a
kind of bag for carrying bed linen, or maybe even a you know, matting bedroll, something like that. But the story is that this gets brought into Caesar's presence and Cleopatra kind of emerges either from the roll or from the bag or whatever. People have said, well, this wouldn't have happened because she was incredibly conscious of her dignity. She would never introduce herself like this. And that's true. Of course, Cleopatra has an incredible sense of her dignity. But more than that, she has an understanding of what makes people she wants to impress tick.
Yeah.
And she will have studied Caesar, and she will have appreciated that he's an intelligent man with a taste for the kind of stunt that she's about to pull. And I think that it's evident that Caesar immediately
takes
Cleopatra's side.
Yeah. In his long years of adventure, Julius Caesar had seen many things, but this was something beyond even his experience. The woman smiled. "Greetings, Commander," she said sweetly. "I am Cleopatra."
Brilliant, Dominic. I'm sure it was exactly like, I mean, the problem is that Caesar himself, so in the commentaries that Caesar writes and that are then after his murder written up by his lieutenants, Caesar barely mentions Cleopatra.
Shocking.
He just as he doesn't mention crossing the Rubicon either in his commentaries. You know, there are certain things that he doesn't want to draw attention to, and he doesn't want to draw attention to his relationship with Cleopatra. Equally, of course, Cleopatra does, because very, very rapidly Cleopatra gets pregnant, and we can only assume that this is absolutely deliberate on both the parts of both of them.
Well, let's just pause a second. She's about 21. He is 52. So that's quite an age gap. But is it plausible? I mean, it's obviously not a love affair, but she's 21. She's presumably reasonably attractive, at least. Plutarch, in his description, he says she's not astoundingly beautiful, but he doesn't say, you know, she's not going to drive you running out of the room. Yeah. Julius Caesar has an eye for the ladies anyway, doesn't he?
Yeah, he's notorious for it.
He's a sort of bad boy.
Yeah.
So, and she knows, so he's the first man that he's her first boyfriend, as it were. Yeah. And she's not approaching this as this sort of, I mean, there's this line that her brother's ministers put about that she's captured the old man by magic. But she must know exactly, I mean, she's doing this politically, right? It's not a romance.
I think that there must have been an attraction between them. They obviously both liked each other.
Yeah.
And in a way, the whole kind of coming out of a sack stunt is Cleopatra's tribute to what a, you know, what an amusing and smart guy Caesar is.
Right.
So I think there's absolutely that dimension. But there's something, you know, both of them have a kind of mutuality of interests, because Caesar suddenly realizes that he's surrounded by a howling mob. And so Achilles, the Ptolemy the 13th general is on the outside, Pothinus is inside. But he realizes that probably the best bet is to get rid of Ptolemy the 13th, put Cleopatra as a puppet. And if he can get Cleopatra pregnant and, you know, establish a dynasty, then that's brilliant, because that gets around the whole problem of what his relationship to Egypt should be. Because if his son is ruling Egypt, then obviously that's great. I mean, that cuts yeah. through the whole Gordian knot of what the constitutional proprieties should be for a Republican general.
Although, of course, that's a problem in Rome, isn't it? Caesar is married already to Calpurnia.
It will be, but I don't think that unduly worries him, because there are many different ways of kind of spinning this. Yeah. Equally for Cleopatra, she has clearly decided that Caesar is the guy to back. She doesn't really have any option but to do that. And if she can establish a dynastic link to the guy who may well end up ruling Rome, then obviously that's brilliant for her. And yeah. of course, her primary object at this point is to get rid of her brother.
So we're in late 48 BC. Pompey's dead. They are in the sort of palace quarter of Alexandria, in this sort of, it's this sort of walled compound, I guess, or at least they've put up barricades or something.
Yeah, so it serves as a fortress.
To stop the population breaking in and Achilles' army. And then, I mean, you said earlier, this really interesting thing, that this is the closest that Julius Caesar comes in his entire military career to disaster, because he's got the small force, they're besieged, because the siege goes on for basically, it's about 6 months or so, isn't it?
Yeah, and he's stuck there and he doesn't know what's going on in the broader strategic sphere of the Mediterranean. I mean, he's got all those enemies out there. It's a disaster for him.
And at one point he has to burn his own fleet to stop the enemy getting hold of it. In the course of that, they accidentally burn down part of the Great Library. I mean, this is one
hugely.
Or is this an urban myth, Tom? Historians are divided about this, aren't they?
It's much, much debated. I think we should do an episode on the Library of Alexandria. It's an incredibly complicated but fascinating story.
Yeah.
And the mysteries that surround it are part of the fascination.
So, but it's possible anyway that part of it was destroyed.
Yeah.
And this incredibly convoluted story. So at one point, they're there in the palace. There's Caesar. There's Ptolemy the 13th. There is Cleopatra.
Pothinus.
Yes. And there is her younger sister, Arsinoe.
Yes, who's a baggage.
Well, she's a teenager, isn't she? She must be about 18 or 19.
Yeah, she's terrible.
But is she though, Tom? So what Arsinoe does, Arsinoe basically breaks out of the palace with her tutor, who's called Ganymede, and they then go and join the rioters, and she sets herself up as a rival, doesn't she,
yeah. Arsinoe? So she's obviously incredibly jealous of her.
She is the Prince Harry of that
family. She's the Princess Margaret.
Right, well, anyway.
They're all awful. They're all murderous. I always kind of think of her as the archetype of the awful little sister who's kind of jealous of the high-achieving yeah. elder sister, resentful and jealous, and always trying to kind of stab her in the back and ruin things for her.
So she's got out. But then Ptolemy, he says, let me go and talk to them. You know, and he says to Julius Caesar, I've learned so much from you. I think you're such a tremendous fellow. I really respect you. Please let me go outside and reason with the rioters. And he goes out to reason with them, but then he sort of turns around and says, ha, I hate you.
Poo face.
Yeah. So, and he joins them as well. So now it's just Caesar and Cleopatra left in the palace.
But Caesar's executed Pothinus.
He's executed Pothinus with his men, and they're trapped and everybody is against them. And there's always all these strange stories about they poison the water supply or they put salt or something in the
Caesar
water supply.
Caesar loses his red general's cloak.
Yeah, Caesar goes out to do some stuff in the harbour and is almost caught and killed. And actually, he's bailed out, isn't he, by a relief army. I mean, he doesn't actually win the day.
Yeah, but led by a kind of Greek potentate, Mithridates of Pergamon. Which
right.
is, you know, mildly humiliating, but Caesar doesn't care because essentially that enables him to redeem the situation, and Ptolemy the 13th ends up drowned and Cleopatra is now kind of secure. So she then marries her youngest brother, who becomes Ptolemy the 14th.
As if we hadn't got enough Ptolemies already.
another one. And Caesar and Cleopatra go on a barge, it's said, and they kind of go on a trip down the Nile.
Well, this is number... So we've had the carpet, and this is probably the next great set piece in the sort of Hollywood version of Cleopatra's life, isn't it? So they go on this cruise. one of probably history's most famous crews. So they go on this sort of Nile cruise and they look at the pyramids and inspect wildlife. And actually, historians have always said, what on earth is Julius Caesar doing? He's meant to be fighting a civil war. And he's sort of gone off on this pleasure barge up the Nile. So what do you think is going on there, Tom?
I think that Caesar is buying into Cleopatra's idea of a dynasty that will be properly rooted in the affections of the Egyptians.
Yeah.
And I think he's playing his part in that. So yeah. Cleopatra going down the Nile, which is the source of life in Egypt, and she is claiming to be the goddess who manifests herself, the giver of life, the giver of fertility. That's what she's doing. She's presenting herself to her people as an authentically Egyptian pharaoh. So Caesar is buying into that. And this is why he can't mention it in his commentaries, because basically he's recognized in these kind of dynastic links that he can have with Cleopatra, that it's a form of power that is not available to any other Roman.
Yeah.
Simply because of his circumstances. So I think that's what he's doing. It's something he absolutely wants to keep quiet. He's not going to trumpet it in Rome because, no one would approve. But, if his son comes to be accepted as a pharaoh ruling in association with her mother, then that is a massive, massive asset for Caesar. And so he establishes that. And then having done that, he sails off, comes, sees, conquers. This is, Veni, Vidi, Vici. This is
because he goes off to Asia Minor, doesn't he?
Yeah, and gets that. Then he defeats all his various republican enemies. He goes back to Rome and he celebrates various triumphs. And among these triumphs is he celebrates an Egyptian triumph. And in the triumph, he leads Cleopatra's younger sister, the young Arsinoe. And this isn't popular. The Roman people don't like seeing her led in chains.
Yeah, because they cheer her or they applaud her or something.
They applaud her.
Cleopatra is now unchallenged. She has a much younger brother who is now her husband, Ptolemy the 14th. She has given birth in June 47 to a son who she calls Ptolemy Caesar. So it's completely upfront that this is Julius. And Caesar doesn't acknowledge the child.
No.
But the name is the giveaway.
But Caesar does invite her to Rome.
She
comes to Rome with her husband, who is also her brother.
Yeah.
And it's all very, very un-Roman.
So Caesar puts them up, doesn't he, in his estate in what's now Trastevere across the Tiber.
Yeah.
And is she there, Tom, do you think, to see? Because historians are not quite sure of the dates, but do you think she was there to see his triumphs? Do you think, would that be plausible?
Interesting to know, isn't it? It's interesting to know whether she put Caesar up to having her sister led in. She gets spared and I think gets settled at Ephesus, isn't it? After the triumph, but Cleopatra certainly she kind of beds down and is very grande dame. And Cicero, the great orator, great kind of intellectual, he's terribly resentful of her. So Alexandria is actually the only place that Cicero said he wanted to visit apart from Rome.
Is that so?
He said Alexandria is the one place I want to visit, but he goes to see Cleopatra and gets snubbed by her. And so he
obviously, there's some source, isn't there, where he writes, he says, I hate the queen. I hate her. Do you want to know how our top children's book describes Cicero from Cleopatra's point of view?
Yeah, I'd love to hear that. Yeah.
A jowly, toad-faced man, smooth and silver-tongued, but monstrously vain and pompous.
Yeah, well, nothing wrong with being monstrously vain and pompous. So Cleopatra's there with Caesarion, her son, her young son, and her brother, who is her husband. It's all very odd.
And they come and go a little bit, don't they, Tom, in the next couple of years? Are they sort of, she's there in 46 BC and then she's there again when, we're jumping ahead, when Caesar finally really does get the boot.
She is. And then she basically, Rome is obviously no place for her.
Yeah.
After her protector is dead. And so she flees back to Alexandria.
So there's obviously during this whole period, Caesar has won the civil war. There is this sort of mounting tension in Rome, this sense that he's going to set himself up as a king and all this sort of business. He's too powerful. He's too domineering. And do you think her presence is part of that?
Yeah, I do. So no one's quite sure what Caesar's going to do. I don't think Caesar knows what he's going to do. So he's planning to go on an attack Parthia, which is the great empire, the only real kind of empire that survives as a rival to Rome. And I think he's going there basically because he's not quite sure what to do. But it's evident, I think, that the kind of dynastic model of rulership that the Ptolemies represent, the kind of Hellenistic tradition of monarchical rule, is of interest to Caesar. He knows that the Romans would never accept it because it's a republic and the name king is absolutely dirty to them. But I think it's kind of hovering there as something that he is tempted to make play with. And I think that Cleopatra's presence in Rome is a kind of marker of that, and to that extent encourages the assassins who end up murdering him on the Ides of March, which is why Cleopatra has no stake at all in staying in Rome after Caesar murdered. And when he's dead, she goes skedaddling back to Alexandria as fast as she can go.
So back she goes to Alexandria.
Where she kills Ptolemy the 14th. So that's him gone. And now she's ruling with Caesarion, who is, three or something?
So why does she kill her brother? That's the most, in all her career, that's probably the single most ruthless and sort of jarring thing that she does. She kills
it's
her.
It's not jarring. It's absolutely.
Or jarring to modern sensibilities, Tom. Murdering your brother
is. She wants to
rule.
Her ambition is to rule, and not just to rule, but to reconstitute the Ptolemaic Empire.
Yeah.
To take it back to its former state of greatness. She can't do that if she has a kind of little brother breathing down her neck, because that little brother will become the thing of rivals to her.
So the
equivalents of people like Achelas and Pythinus will use him as a cipher to strike back at her. And whereas her own son obviously will be massively under her thumb.
And
so of course she's going
to
get rid of him.
The situation in Rome makes it all the more imperative to do that, because her protector in Rome is dead.
Yeah.
The Roman world is slipping into civil war. So the presence of an alternative, is... She can't afford to have him hanging around. I mean, I said it was jarring. It's not jarring to anybody who knows the history of the Ptolemaic dynasty, because obviously the lesson of Ptolemaic history is you do it and you're right to do it.
Yeah. Cleopatra killed him and she was right to kill him.
Yeah,
of course. It was the only sane thing to do.
It was the only sane thing to do.
Because, of course, she is back in Egypt. But meanwhile, as in the early years of her reign, so now the context for what she is doing in Egypt is set by the threat of civil war in Rome and by extension the whole of the Mediterranean. And that is the context for what I think should be episode 3. I think we should halt now.
Yeah.
And episode 3, we should look at what happens with the civil war between Caesar's assassins and Caesar's avengers and the Roman leaders who emerge from that and what their relationship to Cleopatra is.
Excellent. So if you're part of the Rest is History Club, you can go straight to episode 3 right now. If you're not, you can either sign up at restishistorypod.com or you'll have to wait until whenever it is that we release episode 3. But we will see you then for more Cleopatra-based action. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.